The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
With me is Kate O'Connell, former Fine Gael TD, Lise Hand, journalist, and Kevin Cunningham, founder of Ireland Thinks and lecturer in politics in TU Dublin. And Ireland Thinks is all over the Sunday Independent today, polling on a number of things ranging from housing through to the state of the parties, through to people's views on Michael Lowry. But of course, the big issue this weekend is all that has happened in respect of Ukraine. And one of the questions that Ireland Thinks has put to people is whether or not the Taoiseach should make any criticism of President Trump to President Trump when he's in the White House. Kevin, given that this is your data, do you want to tell us what you discovered?
Yeah, so in that particular question, people were asked, should he criticise him, give him any criticism now when he's face-to-face with Donald Trump? 50% say no, 43% yes, 7% undecided. It's particularly interesting, you break that down by parties, you're talking about a left-right split in some respect. You're also observing women more likely to say no in this particular regard, which I thought was quite interesting. Perhaps women know how to deal with a character like Trump in that respect. But it's quite important more generally, because I think it's quite possible that Micheál Martin might be goaded in this conversation. I think I was looking at Lindsey Graham's response to Zelensky's meeting, and he was talking about how, you know, don't rise to the bait. And we clearly have two areas when it comes to things like Gaza and obviously the tariffs, which, you know, it's quite possible we could be goaded, or Micheál Martin could be goaded on those particular topics. So I think it's quite important, certainly for Micheál Martin, to be wary of these. But more generally, when it comes to the public, yeah, they're happy with Micheál Martin going. Vast majority of people want him to go, contrasting very sharply with Sinn Féin's decision to boycott, for which there was very little support for. And I think it reflects the public is quite pragmatic about these things.
The party split is interesting, though, because as you say, when you get into the views of the different party support, People Before Profit are 91% that he should have a go at Trump. Sinn Féin supporters 65%, Social Democrats 62%, and then when you hit Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, it almost reverses. 56% saying don't do it, keep your powder dry.
Yeah, keep your powder dry is exactly what they're saying, you know. And then you can move on to, I think, as I said, this pragmatism, you know, so you can have this thing where people are asked, what should you prioritise? And people are clearly concerned about the tariffs. That's the number one, they think, that issue for them. And I think that reflects the fact that we're pretty much a small player when it comes to these international defence issues. We're probably not going to have the sort of impact that we might like to have. And so really, his interest should be in terms of those economic interests, economic concerns that people have in relation to what Trump might do if aggravated.
Well, on that thing of being aggravated, what happens, Kate O'Connell, if the Taoiseach is sitting there and Donald Trump starts to make statements that are either false or against our interest? If he starts referencing, which he wants to do, Ireland as being a brass plaque operation, or Ireland exploiting tax policy or whatever else, does he sit moot, or does he correct the record?
Well, Micheál Martin's around a long time. He's very experienced, and he's well aware that Trump responds to belly tickling at all points. He just loves being praised. He loves being told how wonderful he is. And I'm sure Micheál Martin has met a variety of that many times along his journey to become Taoiseach of the country. In terms of how he responds, I think he's going to have to keep it very lighthearted and go on out of that there, as my mother-in-law would call him, Donal. Go on out of that, Donald, and, you know, let's keep it clean here. But in terms of protecting Ireland's position, I think there's, you know, Starmer's carving out a place for himself between Europe and America. Are we not best placed in terms of our relationship if we look at the special position of Northern Ireland emerging out of Brexit and the trading relationship there? If I were Micheál Martin heading over, I would be coming up with that novel idea. Trump responds to novel ideas. He's a businessman, to innovation.
And a novel idea in respect of Ukraine?
In the sense of, no, in terms of the north of Ireland. Oh. In terms of using that as sort of, imagine if you could outdo Clinton in terms of peace. Imagine if you could be the main man here. And while we're talking about it, there is a trading relationship that Northern Ireland has as a result of Brexit, which could be a very important hinge between America and Europe. We don't necessarily need to look to Starmer and mainland Britain. We need to look, I think, towards the Northern Ireland idea. And I think Trump will probably respond to that. But I think overall...
I mean, given that Trump congratulated Keir Starmer on having a lovely country because he had Dún Beag, which was in his lovely country, it would suggest he's sketchy on what Ireland is, never mind the Northern Ireland.
Ah, he's the sort of lad, I'd say, he just gets confused. And if he read a memo, he'd get it again. I mean, that sort of... He doesn't see it as that important. He doesn't believe fact and truth really matter that much. He doesn't seem to understand the gravity around his statements. I mean, he have denied he called Zelensky a dictator. So he's well able to lie, but he's well able
well,
to pivot.
What about the Zelensky
well.
Issue and what about the Ukraine issue? When Micheál Martin is there, he is likely to be the first EU leader to be in the White House after the debacle. If he gets asked a question, because there will be Irish media there, and I imagine they will be asking questions about the support for Ukraine if it hasn't been resolved between now and then, what does he do?
I think he focuses on peace. And it seems Trump keeps referring back to the slaughter, both of Ukrainian people and the deaths of Ukrainian people and the deaths of Russian soldiers and the impact on civilians. So I think it would be a good idea for Micheál Martin to hone in on that. We've had our troubles on this island too. We know what war is like. We've seen, and we've the OMA inquiry going on at the minute, which is refreshing all that in the minds of people who've forgotten it. I think our history as a country of civil war and violence and death, I think we can kind of tap into that. And I think Trump will probably respond to it. Anything that gives him something over everybody else, he loves it.
Where do you stand, Lise, on this breakdown as to the almost 50-50, he should criticise him, he shouldn't? What's your take?
I think he's literally walking into the lion's den, because you have absolutely no idea what mood he's going to be in, what has he seen on television that's going to enrage him that day. You're dealing with someone who's utterly transactional, and you're dealing with somebody that might, you know... Absolutely, he preys on Micheál Martin, and then he's no sooner out the door when he's up on Truth Social doing a 200-word rant about how Ireland is a disgrace and, you know, taking all American taxes. So I mean, there's probably a small part of Micheál Martin that's praying for second COVID positive test as soon as he hits the States, or maybe throw himself down government buildings. Because the thing about, I mean, I have covered, I've been in the Oval Office five times covering this very event, right? I've covered five different occasions. And the thing is, you know, it normally looms massively large in the Irish psyche. There's huge, you know, obviously there's huge interest in it. But as a rule, it goes really unnoticed in the rest of the international community. You know, it's a big deal for Ireland. It's just one other thing on a US president's schedule. Yes, there is the added thing that there is a bipartisan lunch, which actually is probably much more important in terms of getting things done on Capitol Hill. But this is different, because now everybody is going to be watching. I mean, the pressure on Micheál Martin is absolutely enormous. And to be honest, the poor devil, he's really probably in a lose-lose situation, because if he goes in and is overly aggressive, the repercussions for Ireland could be absolutely serious. But if he goes in and rolls over and, you know, lets his belly be tickled, he's going to get excoriated at home for not being strong enough. So he's in a really, really, really difficult position. And the only thing he can do, and I mean, there's a massive to-ing and fro-ing at the moment, as we see, he's going to be talking to Zelensky again. There's going to be powwows between the EU leaders trying to strategize. But I think he can't. You can go in with plan A, B, C, D and E and F, but you don't know what you're getting on that day, because you are dealing with somebody who is absolutely mercurial in terms of their wants, their needs, their mood. And you just have to go, he has to go in there with a whole, about six or seven different game plans.
And I assume what makes this particularly different, you referenced the five that you have covered before.
Yeah.
Normally, my understanding is they are pre-prepared to be as anodyne as humanly possible. Everybody knows what is going to happen. Whereas what we saw with the Zelensky meeting is nobody knows what's going to happen.
Well, I mean, absolutely. It's normally a set piece and it's always very jolly. I was there when President Obama announced he was visiting Ireland. It tends to be very positive, and it tends to be usually reasonably minor things. Like, and I don't mean this, I mean on a world scale things. You know, the Taoiseach of the day would bring up something like the undocumented Irish and whatever. A big deal for those involved, but on the, you know, world stage, not a big deal. So, you know, it tends to be set piece, grip and grin, one or two very anodyne questions from the, you know, from the press gaggle there. And let me not mention the Lutheramon that asked the question about the suit. I mean, I think I was actually posting that if I'd been in the room, I probably would have picked up one of those gilded statuettes and I would have brained him, because you have only a few questions and that's what you were actually waiting
for. Well, now, hang on a minute. What was he? One American News?
Oh, I think that's one American. Yeah, he was one American News.
Now, I don't want to be mercenary, Lise, but if you are one American News and you manage to get the question that causes the president to congratulate you and that gets that level of attention and that scratches your audience where you itch, are you not doing your job?
No, you're not doing your job. You're there to hold the speak truth to power and hold powerful to account. You're in the most powerful room possibly
has
in the
that
world.
Ship not long since sailed? Are
no,
we still clinging
no.
to that
I mean,
belief?
I'm sorry. There's times and places you can ask that question. If you're in there and you have one question maybe to like out of the entire press pack to ask, you don't waste it on that. It's an absolute. My jaw was swinging on the floor for that one. Now it really was. But anyway, sorry, that was just an absolute side issue.
I was going to say, but didn't Trump immediately after that question sort of defend Zelensky's honor in some way, in some respect, which kind of showed how the conversation progressed and how it got more and more aggressive as a result, I think, of J.D. Vance's insertion into the conversation. I think that really influenced how things went. And you could see by contrast how Keir Starmer was able to manage this very, very well, to be honest with you. He was able to come out of it getting Trump to say things like Zelensky isn't a dictator, I guess, and moving him in a certain direction. I just think Micheál Martin needs to be very careful about how he actually navigates this, because I think the tough questions will come.
It'll be interesting to see. I don't think J.D. Vance will be in the room this time, because there's the Taoiseach's day starts off with a separate breakfast event at the Naval Observatory. The Vice President actually hosts a breakfast, which again tends to be very much heavy on the shamrock and very light on policy. Now, it'll be interesting to see, does J.D. Vance decide to insert himself and go along to the White House? Because
that was one of the things that I thought was very interesting in the way that even that meeting was set up, to put somebody in a position where they're operating in a language which isn't their own and to surround them. So one individual representing Ukraine, and you then have the President, Vice President, Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, plus everybody else and the American media. I mean, talk about walking into a crucible.
Well, I mean,
designed
or an ambush.
It was designed to be that.
Yeah,
an ambush.
I mean, in terms of the commentary about his rig out at the doors, then followed up with your man asking about it, and then Vance and that intimidatory circle. It was very much a pylon, whether it was planned or not. Zelensky walked into it. He's on the back foot. No one warned him clearly that this could happen. I mean, he didn't seem to have the capacity to stop it and go, actually, you know, I honour you greatly, Donald, or whatever you have to say.
I still struggle, because I've tried to rethink this a few times. I still struggle to see when he's put in a position where he is being handed the proposition, in essence, that there are two equal combatants in this war, him and Russia, and there's good people on both sides. How does he not counter that argument? You know, how do you hold back if you're him?
Well, he did, I suppose. I don't know how you do it, especially when you're caught like that. And when it must have been evolving in his head in the moment, going, oh my God, this is such an unusual situation. And I think the language barrier did have a huge...
Oh, it must, because he has said himself that his English isn't
translations
great.
Of things. And clearly they're extremely different people. And, you know, that poor old Zelensky's the worst 3 years going, and he'd slaughter his people, and he's... I suppose his support is on, but he's also coming on the back of all this lies that Trump has told in terms of the poll rating, just trying to constantly diminish, constantly denigrate him. And then he decided to do it in full view of the world.
It's also an interesting parallel between him and Putin, because Putin speaks very good English, but refuses to do so. Carries a translator to buy himself time so that he can understand the conversation, but he still has a translator.
But on a positive, no matter how bad things go for Micheál Martin, it can't go as badly as it went for Zelensky. Like, no matter how bad
it
goes.
They pulled off the bad cop routine once now, so at least that could be folded into the strategy.
There's an interesting take on your poll, Kevin, saying that the 47% Ireland thinks poll showing that Ireland should criticise Trump during the Patrick's Day visit is just further proof that half of this country shouldn't be given a vote. There is not a single Irish job, pension payment or school place funding worth losing for Gaza, Ukraine or talking tough to Trump. And if a person doesn't understand that, then let them be the first in the queue to lose their job or social protection payment.
Yeah, I mean, this comes back to the idea that I think in terms of a median voter in Ireland, that median voter is a very, very pragmatic voter. It's coming down to money, money, money is really all that matters at the centre of it all. And yeah, they are minority interests in some respect. Gaza,
well,
and Ukraine.
Well, then square that with the coverage this weekend, because we have the Business Post telling us that Ireland is backing a €20 billion war fund. That there may be a bill of up to €750 million to pay. The front of the Irish Mail saying Ukraine aid doubled to €100 million straight away off the back of that meeting. Yeah. Government is investing hand over fist.
I mean, there is while I say money, there is a move towards further defence spending. There is increased support, let's say, for even Ireland's membership of things like NATO, or the dismantling of the triple lock moved by about 8 points. But you still have vast majorities opposed to those sorts of changes. I think one of the things observed in this poll, at least, which was quite interesting, was that most people now favour, very, very minorly, an EU army, and in fact, Irish involvement in such a thing. And it's reflected that middle ground of centre-left voters who are kind of in that realm, I guess. But yeah, I mean, defence spending is relatively popular, I guess. 60-odd% of people actually favour increases in defence spending. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is the reality of where things are going, even following that meeting, that it is the EU that seems to be the answer to many crises. And you can go back to things like COVID, how we dealt with that in relation to the vaccines. The EU was the solution when it came to the various different banking crises. You created the EU banking union. I think the European Union seems to be the answer when we have...
My God, though, there's some difference between centralised regulation of the banks and fighter jets in Shannon.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know, but it's definitely a more difficult task. But it is interesting to see this distinction when it comes to the idea that people are very much opposed to any sort of involvement of Ireland in NATO, but still there's a slight majority in terms of an EU. And I think that is the direction and the big implication of what's happened.
What do you make of that, Kate O'Connell? Do you think that is now the direction of travel? Because there's kites being flown about major investment in fighter jets so that we can patrol our own airspace. And there's a lot of questions saying, if, as Elon Musk is suggesting, the US moves out of NATO, who patrols the waters around Ireland? What role does the EU have in its own security? All that points to huge militarism, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think Irish people are obviously uncomfortable with this. We're all brought up in a country that the neutral flag is flown. But I do think, arising from Trump's narrative and his utterances, that the vast majority of people realise that we can't just hide out here the other side of Britain and hope no one comes near us, that we do need to protect ourselves and that we are at risk. And whilst I was joking at home, God bless anyone that tries to come and conscript my lad out of bed on a Sunday morning to do something. But, you know, that is the reality. That was never part of our lives in this country. But we can't just, I suppose, hide in the bosom of Europe and expect them to protect us if, as we've seen, the Russians are coming around the south coast of Ireland, and huge vulnerabilities in terms of the power cables. And, you know, if the lights and the power is cut off, we need to have our allies. We're not able to fight it ourselves.
Although it is instructive.
It's uncomfortable, but it's reality.
It's instructive of what a minnow we are, because we're looking at this meeting that is happening across the water in London today. And you've got Norway, Poland, Spain, Canada, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Italy, France, Germany, Ukraine, the Czech Republic, Romania, the whole cast of characters know us.
Well, yes, but I think, so to go back to something Kate said, I think that, you know, we've traded for a long time off the fact we are a little small island off the West Coast hanging onto the Atlantic, and, you know, we're not really that important. And I think it has led to us being very complacent about the fact that we actually geographically are important, because we are on the very edge of Europe. We're the closest land, you know, nation to the States. We do have, and also the undersea cables are of massive importance. I mean, it's interesting.
And market access. I mean, the only English-speaking country.
And market access. And, you know, the fact that we are the hub for so many US multinationals and so on. So, I mean, we are much more important than we think. And we have really, probably to a certain extent, sort of turned a blind eye to the shortcomings we have. I mean, I think every Irish person felt a bit morto when you see RAF fighter jets, you know, chasing off stray aircraft, or, you know, from the coast of Ireland, or, you know, submarines, EU submarines, you know, scaring off the Russian subs sniffing around the undersea cables. And I mean, they are, we've seen sabotage been perpetrated on them. And I think it's really interesting the fact that people, and polls are showing that people are, who were once, if you mention the word anything to the European army spending on defence, would have been up in arms going, pardon the pun, going, no, 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 absolutely no way, no way. And the fact that you're seeing a softening in that, I think people are starting to think in self-interest, like we don't need to be a basket case and scare off. And I did laugh when I saw Leo Varadkar has a column in the Sunday Times today, and he ends it by quoting, of all people for Leo to be quoting, Vladimir Lenin. But he just was quoting Lenin, saying there are decades when nothing happens and there are weeks when decades happen when it comes to politics. Well-known quote. But my goodness, isn't that where we are right now? If you think that literally Donald Trump, the Trump administration is in power 6 weeks, and it already feels like 6 years.
There are issues closer to home that we should discuss. One of the things that the Ireland Thinks poll has looked at is who is winning the public or the propaganda battle in respect of the speaking rights row in the Dáil. We will get a bit of analysis on that after this break. Kate, the speaking rights row. We sort of thought this was going to be a spectacle for the first day and then we would get on with our lives. We haven't gotten on with our lives. Who's right in all of this?
I believe the opposition are right. I believe they're right to dig in on this one. And it's going to be interesting how it plays out over the next few weeks, because now there's the accusations of they're going to hold up conducting business abroad and the pairing element. But
now explain pairing, the significance of pairing.
Where there's, in this case, there's, isn't it a majority of 8, I think, when you take in the group of 9 like-minded independents, of which a number are in ministerial positions. But in order to if a vote was called in the Dáil, you need to have the one side balancing the other for those in power to have more votes. And pairing arrangements, somebody's having a baby or if someone's sick or having an operation or off in America or for some reason detained elsewhere. So by pulling away those arrangements by the opposition...
So saying, we do a deal where if I'm on holiday, you stay away if you would otherwise vote against.
Yeah, yeah. And it's done by the whips. The whips organise it. And it's done in a way that business can continue and that the government doesn't fall based on a technicality.
Now, Micheál Martin has made the argument that says, look back ranging from Tony Gregory through to Confidence and Supply, there is ample previous precedent wherein parties who were privy to or party to the negotiation of the programme for government have had opposition speaking time. This is no different.
Yeah, but it depends, I suppose, where you look back to. So this, to my mind, all emerged when Confidence and Supply and the non-majority government element emerged, where, first of all, in my time, was Confidence and Supply, and then you had the coalition of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens. And this 9-person, I actually questioned at the time, I thought, why do they need 9? Why couldn't 4 do? But this is to give cushioning. And you don't want a situation where you'll have, like in the past administration, Nessa Hourican, or I can't think of the gentleman, Hazel Chew's husband, she'd be delighted me calling him that, can't think of his name. So both of those lost the whip in their time. So you can't have flaky Greens, you know, upsetting your progress when you're in power. So these 9 drill baby drill style independents, you know, pro road, you know, pro dairy farming, you know, skeptical about some elements of the green agenda, that this grouping, this 9, would let Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil do what you do in power, get your legislation through. But in terms of what's happened...
But point is, this has happened before. Larry is case in point. We have relied on Larry's vote before. Why is this any different?
It wasn't nailed on, written down. It was an unwritten thing in my time, Larry would vote. But in this case, he's nailed on as one of the people that leads to... one of the people leading a group that leads to this majority. And the reality is, if you look back, and I haven't looked back, but if the people who look back on these things look back, if you look at how does Michael Lowry operate in the Dáil, many of his contributions in the past have been under leaders' questions, under questions and promise legislation. They have been Dáil minutes of time when he was in opposition.
Opposition time.
Yes, opposition time. If you look to Michael Lowry's, I'd call it the workhorse work of committees, that the people like the Alan Kellys of this world who go in and slog hard, and I would consider myself one of those back in the day, people who do huge amounts of committee work, I can't remember ever Michael Lowry in recent decades having done a huge amount of his rock this work in committee. So Michael, fundamental, I would say, to Michael Lowry's way of doing business is to ask questions on the Dáil floor.
Okay. And always well, your given core argument is this is different because they're written down and
they're
nailed
written down,
on.
Nailed
is she right, Lise? Is the difference that they're nailed on?
I think there's sort of several differences. I think the from the very word that from the very moment that this was sort of unveiled as the way forward, the word stroke started getting thrown around and it very quickly gained traction that people saw this as different. They didn't see this as trying to put together something workable, you know, in that would actually enhance democracy. They saw it as a way of cynically putting together something that seemed to circumvent or bypass the normal routines.
It didn't look like. What was Jackie Healy-Ray? What was Tony Gregory?
I was saying this is about perception, and I think that's it, right? The Jackie, I mean, I sat through many a Dáil up in the Dáil Gallery watching Jackie Healy-Ray in action and so on. And it was different, right? It was a case of you got a few people and you bought them and they stayed bought. This was putting together something that just didn't sit right. It seemed to be. Something put in place to undermine the way that business is done rather than just change it. It's very hard to explain, but people just immediately saw this somehow as it being a stroke, as a cynical throwback to days when governments pulled a fast one. I mean, I have lost count the amount of times I've listened to an interview with Micheál Martin since then, when things that he said about Michael Lowry back in the past were have been flung straight in his face. And people pick up on that and they see it as being cynical and trying to be smart, and it just isn't sitting
and
well.
And his response seems to be effectively that the repeated mandate has washed him in the water. That the fact of getting returned a lot means you eventually forgive.
Yes, and I think so. And it's interesting that this has been a fractious Dáil from the very start, right? It really has. It started in bad temper and it has continued so. And this shows no sign of lessening. And that isn't playing well with the general public.
Well, this brings in Kevin. What's the general public attitude?
Well, okay, yeah. So the general public on this particular issue, people were asked whether in terms of dealing with Michael Lowry, whether the government is right to do so or not. That's pretty much unchanged. 62% saying no, 25% saying yes. What side people are on when it comes to this particular debacle, 59% say the opposition, 26% say the government. And the reason why that 26% is interesting is because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael collectively are on 44%. So that means quite a lot of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil voters are not happy with this particular outcome at all. So I think more generally, the interesting thing about this is also the secrecy of it. The idea of secret deals in some respects that aren't necessarily in the programme for government does hark back to an older time when you do these kind of secret deals for constituencies. To do a constituency level deal, that in effect is illegal, but we don't actually see where, and we know perhaps or suspect perhaps that there are some constituency deals underlying the agreement that's been made here with Michael Lowry and his group of independent
And the opposition
TDs.
Knows that. Whatever about us, the opposition is very much aware of that. And if you look to the party of nine, and there's a couple of them in super junior jobs, and we have Verona as the Ceann Comhairle, everybody's going, don't take us for fools. The spares, whatever's left over after the juniors and the Ceann Comhairle, they're getting something. They're not there for the good of Ireland. They're there for the good of, well, we would assume that they're there for the good of their constituents, a wing in Clonmel Hospital, a bit of a motorway down going around New Inn, or whatever you're having yourself. And that is the reality of it. People don't want to be taken for fools.
Now, do people, and I don't know whether or not you did temperature polling on this, but do people care, Kevin? Because it's getting an awful lot of attention.
Yeah,
is it getting an awful lot of emotion?
It doesn't get much. So one of the ways in which you can actually measure that is you ask people an open-ended question, what is actually the most important issue? It just does not feature at all. So on that basis, I'm not sure if it's like top of the mind. And one of the things that does feature in those open-ended was the conversation that we had earlier. Donald Trump and that sort of thing is really coming through.
That's all?
Yeah, so like let's say next month we'll have to include Trump as one of the categories of what people care about the most, because that's just come through. Yeah, and it's the same thing happened with the cost of living back in the day when it just came through as a massive issue.
But I'm intrigued by that because you never know whether or not the international stuff, you know, affects the, you know,
most
butter's parson up closer to home. But this is
the Trump stuff is
I think there's a difficulty for the government here in that why aren't they rowing back on this? If it didn't matter, if this Lowry thing didn't matter, should then just, you know, give in to the opposition. The fact that the heels are being dug in so much and this idea, and quote the newspapers, is ramming through. Well, that's what majorities do. They do ram through. That's the nature of it. But I do think this ramming through will be, I suppose, a view into what will happen for the next 5 years.
And the trouble is, I mean, Micheál Martin's going to come back from, you know, from Washington with, and there's just going to be, this is still going to be rumbling on. I mean, it's totally insane. Though I suppose on a, you know, if you want to find out something positive about his trip, I suppose the international world and media are going to be introduced to the Irish concept of plomos, which
I saw Fiona Sheehan use the term that they were doing a deal effectively with Ireland's equivalent of MAGA, but in this case it was MIRA, which was Make Ireland Rural Again, which is his kind of turn of phrase.
Well, we're looking at the future of Ireland briefly. We should look at what the Sunday Times analysis has done. The Sunday Times has looked at the likely cost of a united Ireland, and I think eye-watering is the term. An annual bill, annual, every year, 22 billion quid in welfare payments.
Yes, I'd say that'll stop a few people in their track. But encouragingly, the fact that this, I think it was Heather Humphreys that initially, she initiated this particular piece of inquiry. And it's good to, on a positive note, it's good to see that this is actually the approach they're taking. How much will it cost? Go and actually do the figures. It's all very well waving flags and talking about, you know, four green fields and all that, but what practically will it cost?
22 billion.
And is it going to cost 22 billion? And that is the cost of equality, because you're talking about bringing up some payments here and bringing down some payments elsewhere, or do you bring everybody up? For instance, one of the examples they use is disability payments. There's only something like 4.6% of people in the Republic are in receipt of disability payments. It's 37%, which is an extraordinary figure. And I mean, that to me actually speaks to the level of still dysfunction and neglect.
Oh, and look at the public sector employment north of the border as well. That's
precisely. And so the border might be invisible, but the divides between the economies are absolutely huge. So I think that by actually laying all the figures out, and not sort of saying, oh, well, I mean, the Brits will pay for everything for the next few years. Why should they?
Kevin, you inhaled me.
Yeah, well, Leo Varadkar had a piece which suggested he wasn't as concerned with the economics. And I'd actually kind of agree with that. I think in the long run, the economics are probably positive, because, I mean, the poorest counties in Ireland are those that are affected by the border on a per capita basis. Donegal is clearly the poorest, and that's because it's basically cut off from the rest. I think if you remove that border, effectively, it will create economic...
22 billion per annum?
Well, isn't that just the cost, never mind the increased tax revenue that might occur? And I remember it being suggested it was like 6 or 7 billion per annum. I mean, one of the bigger difficulties is the political dynamic. I mean, I think that's the fundamental problem. And you could see, even in Germany, many, many years after they unified, you can still see massive political differences, where the AfD are really popular in East Germany, and in West Germany it's a completely different political system. I think we're going to have that same sort of dynamic if we had unification. But the point he makes, which I would very much agree with, is if you try and have a referendum before there's going to be a solid majority there, it might not pass, and that would set the whole thing back much further. And he points to the possibility, which I think is really interesting, of a future Tory reform government, a very MAGA-style UK government, which might actually accelerate things. And I think that's quite
interesting. Once they don't find any rare minerals in the north, we're sorted, aren't we?
Kate O'Connell, thank you. Kevin Cunningham, likewise. Kevin Cunningham, founder of Ireland Thinks and lecturer in politics at TU Dublin. And thank you to Lise Hand, journalist.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.